part of the time, but that kind of a vehicle is capable of sustaining numbers like 95 miles per gallon. Have you heard numbers like that, John? Periodically, I hear numbers like that. KQLIW, you got it, John?
Yes, I have, Dick. Those are the numbers. And there's another issue, too, with hydrogen cars. The fuel tank and the danger of it. Although one thing good about hydrogen, it burns up. It doesn't burn like gasoline. So it's safer that way. But I just can't imagine hydrogen such a volatile item, more than gasoline, out with John Q. Public yet. You know, they could probably buffer the impact of the fuel tanks and all, but I think we would see some terrible disasters. But yes, I have seen those cars that are doing 100 miles, 98 miles per gallon. And that is another step forward. And yeah, we're going to have problems with the prototype model. Then they're going to have the first couple out there. They're going to have problems. But I think everything can be solved if they just get some of it out in the field. California was looking to go forcibly for every vehicle in the next 8 years, I think. Maybe we need a state to start pushing it. They're a little wacky out there in their restrictions, but maybe we need that to be the impetus for the whole country.
It seems like a couple of years ago, California got themselves in trouble by setting some very strict rules with reference to electrical power generation, and the net result was the electric power companies were selling all of their power out of state, and therefore there was a real power shortage within the state. Now, I think California is also coming up with some very strict rules that have to be enforced in the next couple of years, that vehicles have to get some ridiculous miles per gallon. Do you happen to know what those numbers are, John? Go ahead.
I believe they were saying they wanted a minimum of 45 miles per gallon. And California also has water issues as some of the other western states, and that they're bringing heavy documentation to support legislation for their water problems, too. And water is going to be a problem. Eventually, Mexico is going to get nothing out of that river. So we're going to have to make corrections there, too. Everything's coming at once, and we don't have the talent to solve them all at once. So we've got to work on get one problem solved, but we're just not doing it yet.
Okay, see, your remembrance is that you're remembering that California desires 45 miles per gallon, and is that going to be the law for vehicles sold within the state of California in, say, 2 or 3 years? And do the automobile companies say they can meet that, or are they just going to stop selling new cars in California? What do you think, John?
Yeah, the industry objected vehemently. They don't think they can comply. I believe it was within five years they wanted that, and they said it just wasn't doable. And maybe that's why we have this great push for the hybrid cars, because that'll at least quiet it down. And maybe that's what they're doing to force the shift to get what they want. Might be a good plan.
There are people who think that a purely battery-operated car is some kind of a solution. I'm a bit skeptical on that one, because where does the energy come from to charge the batteries? You plug it in, and the local power station that's running on coal or petroleum or gas, loading the carbon, adding to the carbon loading of the atmosphere, is where the raw energy is coming from that charges your battery. So that's not a great solution. You're just shifting the place where you're doing the burning of the fossil fuels. A hybrid car, if it is capable of sustaining something close to 90 miles per gallon, sounds like an awful good way to go for the time being. When it comes to a hydrogen-powered vehicle, I guess you're saying the hydrogen fuel cell was going to be not for vehicles. I'm not convinced that a hydrogen-fueled vehicle is the great way to go. I think we're going to have to stick with petroleum. The nice thing about petroleum is that my automobile will give me, on a good day, 450 miles in a tank of petroleum. That's awful convenient. Whereas the guys with battery-powered vehicles have a devil of a time getting beyond about 60 or 70 miles. And that's very inconvenient from my point of view. So right now, hybrid vehicles are kind of expensive. Is there a method of production that we can bring that price down? Anybody got an opinion on that one? K2RIW?
K2RIW.
Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, I don't know. The one thing which I would suggest more is, you know, I think they started to bring more at one point and possibly using some sort of government incentive with it, where you can get the car that you can get that money back, or vice versa, go directly through the factory to bring the price down. But I think at this point, you know, just because it's so new, you're really in a jam with price. So I think the best thing right now would be for the government to step in and get some assistance.
I think part of the reason why a hybrid vehicle is so expensive is it really is a battery-powered car with a petroleum engine backing up the charging of the battery. So you've got all of the electronics for the batteries, all of the electronics for the motors that powers the wheels and the transmission. And the good news is that the number of transmissions and the amount of transmission ratios required go down tremendously when you're using a brushless DC motor. I just recently bought a new washer machine, and it's a Whirlpool washer machine, a fairly modern design, top loader, and I think the whole thing is running on brushless DC motors. At least it gives the sound of the brushless DC motors that I hear on the brushless DC motor electric-powered radio-controlled model aircraft that I see every year at the NEAT Fair, N-E-A-T. I think it's Northeast Electro Aero Technology, I think is the name of the group, the ASLE, Astronomical Society. Well, no, that's astronomical. Can't even think of the name of the organization that backs them up on Long Island. Anyhow, brushless DC motors have come a long way. When you see one of these electric-powered airplanes fly for 5, 8, 10 minutes, producing numbers like 3,000 watts during that whole time. Wow. So those engines have power, efficiency, controllability. I mean, some of these aircraft, it looks like a motor-powered glider. And the thing will fly across the field at, let's say, 50 miles an hour, nice and quiet and slow. And then you hit full power, and you aim the airplane straight up. And this airplane with a... Oh, let me think now. 100 inches is what? 6 times?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
This airplane with a 4.5 or 5 foot wingspan, straight up, has enough power to go out of sight in about 8 seconds. It can climb to about 5,000 feet in 8 seconds. Wow. That thing got power. And that's the highest power one. Some of those aircraft, when the pilot turns on the power full blast, he can only do it for a couple of seconds at a time because the engine overheats, and it makes an extremely loud rapping sound because the tips of the blades of the propeller are exceeding the speed of sound when you go to full power. That's an electric-powered, radio-controlled model airplane. They may call that thing a model. It really is a remotely piloted vehicle. It's got all kinds of capability. They have to do a lot of things to create safety, to make sure that the aircraft don't come very close to the crowd. Everything is very carefully marked off as to where the pilot stands, where his spotter stands to make sure he's not running into other aircraft, and where the aircraft itself is allowed to go on this field that's about a half a mile long and a quarter of a mile wide where this event takes place. And something like 300 or 400 pilots from about 15 or 20 states will show up to this event, and it's a really big deal. I think they get numbers like 75 vendors and hundreds of pilots, a total of 4,000 or 5,000 people come together for a 3-day event to watch this thing in every September. I went to one last September, which I think was the 10th annual NEAT fair. You Google those words and you'll find out something about what these electric-powered aircraft can do. So the bottom line I'm saying here now is with the right kind of control circuitry on a brushless DC motor, you have a ridiculous amount of variability. You can make that motor move real slow, small, like a stepper motor. You can make it move at 36,000 RPM if you want to. There's no brushes to wear out. You can make it go clockwise or counterclockwise. All of that is the rate at which the electronics is controlling which coil in the stator, the outer winding, which coils are getting current at what period of time. Very fancy design. So they've come a long way with motors. As such, electric-powered vehicles with those kind of motors need a lot less variability of the transmission, maybe no transmission at all. So I see the possibility, when you put it all together, that a hybrid vehicle could be done for a rather economic price. The internal reciprocating combustion engine can be only a small number of horsepower. It's used to run a generator that charges the battery. The battery runs the electric motors. The battery runs the electronics that powers the brushless DC motors. And a brushless DC motor at each wheel can give you the equivalent of thoroughly variable four-wheel drive. No differential is required because with the right kind of electronics, you can tell the left-hand wheel to turn a little bit faster than the right-hand wheel because you're making a right-hand turn. So a lot of the stuff is quite massive with a lot of gear.
Oh, Dick, that's the beauty of DC motors, and now just the steam engines. Apply the energy, you got 100% of that engine right from the start, and they can do a job. In fact, those planes are Homeland Security has to worry about. I'm sure you said this before. But quick back to the energy thing. We have tremendous coal reserves. We have oil shale. We have oil sand. Things that can be processed very easily now. And with a lot less pollution. They say they can do a clean job, but they're not being given a chance. We have enough coal in this country for the next 300 years. I remember as a very young adult, there was something called coal oil, which was used in lanterns before you could buy kerosene at the hardware store and stuff like that. So there's so many avenues that it seems like they're forcing us to look at specifics rather than look at everything. And it's probably due to money and the people in power, as it usually goes. But we're in big trouble, and I just think we have to look elsewhere. But I love those planes. I've seen a few of those fly, Dick, and they are joy to pop. You're right. Back to you, Dick.
About the guy who is gathering one and he intended to use it as a bombing device, possibly in Washington, D.C., and they showed you a picture of the particular airplane, the radio-controlled model airplane that he was going to use. I recognize that particular airplane. It's a turbine-powered. And if that's what he was thinking of doing, he was really going the wrong way. The turbine-powered electric aircraft gives you an extremely high whining sound of that turbine, but their power-to-weight ratio is much, much smaller than the ones with a real propeller out in front. His payload capability of that particular aircraft would have been awfully small. Yes, it can move fast, but his payload capability was very small. His other aircraft he could have chosen that would have given him much more capability. But it's good that our Homeland Security is keeping track of things like that. I think he was in the process of gathering the raw materials for the bomb. And it was not just saying to people who were acting friendly to him, but in reality they were double agents. Isn't that what happened, John? Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, there's always somebody in the crowd, either for dollars or because that's their job. They do a good job, and they're protecting us pretty well. But Medic, I'm not so much worried about him actually putting a bomb on his craft, because I don't think he'd be able to get the type of material that could do big damage. So if he's going to do one of those ammonia fuel oil things, that's not going to get... There's no way he's going to produce enough explosive effects to do anything. You know, even TNT, it's not going to really do much. But just the psychological effect would send us reeling again. And you know, the politicians, and more money is going to be spent. And it's just draining us from all different angles. It's a little frustrating at times. I know better times are coming, but I hope they come soon. Back to you, Dick.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, in regards to these motors versus, turbine type of motors, they have them now in these little model speedboats. And when I say little, one by 12 were about, maybe 20 inches to 2 feet long. And one guy had an electric one. Another guy had one. It looked like some kind of a gas, almost like a nitromethane type of thing, like you would put into a race car, some kind of a tanker. I didn't talk to them long. They were leaving when I arrived, right here on Lake Ron Costa, a couple of weeks ago. Went down there, and I heard these. I mean, this one engine was screaming. Like you said, the turbine, this thing was making a lot of noise. I was far away. I was up in a parking lot, maybe about 500, 600 feet away, and this thing was screaming on the lake. And I saw it going. I couldn't believe it. And then another guy had the electric one. Let me drop it. And they were almost, the electric guy was almost catching up to the, I could see, it was powerful, but not quite as powerful as the gas-operated one. And as far as questions, I only got one question really in before they were both leaving. And the gas-powered one goes 50 miles an hour on the water. And the other one, I could see, wasn't too far behind, maybe about 40 miles an hour. I don't know what these things cost or anything like that, but boy, it's really something. Of course, they're all, remote controlled as well. But, for boats, they are really something to watch. I think it's just as probably cool as the airplanes. Back to you, Dick.
It used to be considered impossible to can buy at a rather high price a miniaturized model aircraft, or model boat in your case, a turbo jet engine. In other words, it's really got a set of compressor stages and burning cans inside and turbines, output power and so on. It's a real turbojet engine running on a fuel somewhat similar to gasoline. And there's an electric engine version of that, which is what that model was that the guy was going to be using for his terrorist capability attempt. And they have very low power to weight ratio, but a real turbojet engine. You've heard one run. I've seen them, but I've never heard one run. The neat fare is purely electric powered. There's no petroleum-powered engines anywhere in this electric show that's held once every year. Pleasant Valley Campground is located. So, how big was this engine? And was it really gas-powered? And I bet you it was quite expensive. So, you heard it from a long distance away. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I was in the playground with my grandkids, and I tell you, I think that's probably about 1,000 feet or more away from that. I'm on a hill looking down at the lake, and, it sounded like a real boat. Something high-powered. DB wise, I guess if you were down by the lake next to us, like eventually I was, I don't know, 50, 60 dB, it was loud. And then the electric one was very quiet. I mean, it had a high pitch to it. But dB-wise, you know, you're looking at like, you know, 30 dB compared to 60 dB thing from the turbo thing. Big difference. But fast, and I, you know, when he guns it, there we go. You could tell it was nothing going. Not the electric one, but it, maybe 40, you know, 35, that type of thing. But the other one was really hauling thing.
That 50-mile-an-hour boat, was that a conventional-looking hull, or was that some kind of a hydroplane like the way it made contact with the water? Over to you, Paul.
It was conventional, I can tell you. The guy flipped it over at the end, and then the other guy had to go get his rubber raft and go out and row out and get it. It had a flat bottom. And no propeller, you know, it's like some kind of, you know, like a water jet system on both of them.
No propeller. Now, was this a turbojet engine powered, let's call it an airboat? Is that what it was, Paul? Go ahead.
I think the turbo was running, driving a pump. Pumps were driving water. That's what, you know, I got a close look at it for maybe, a minute or so, and they were gone. You know, they pulled the boats out. You know, they were just leaving. So, you know, my timing was right for being there, but if I was there earlier, I know I could have gotten more questions. And quite a few people standing around watching these two guys.
Dick, would it be more efficient to use a catamaran style or a trimaran?
When it comes to hull speed, I think you're right, John. Paul, was the thrust of that 50-mile-an-hour boat coming from squirting water out of the back of the boat, or was it squirting air? What was really making the thrust? And the engine itself sounds like it was petroleum-powered, and was it a turbojet engine, or was it a reciprocating internal combustion engine? Over to you, Paul.
This was some kind of turbo thing, the guy said. And you could tell, you know, when he turned it on, he was out in the lake. It was, you know, the noise was building up, and then it took off, you know. That's the way a turbo would go. And whether or not it was pushing air, I thought it was water. I can't tell you. I didn't have enough time to look. Well, I go down there quite a bit, so if they're down there again, I'll look into it. Maybe what I should do is look on the internet. I'll probably find something similar to it. But nothing fancy about these boats. I mean, you know, it wasn't like a modeler's dream. They were like, it looks like it was bought this way. And all engine, and I didn't even see the batteries on the... I didn't see the batteries on the electric one or the motors. Not a close enough look. But all I can tell you is they got them. And, of course, they're both remote control.
Sounds like it was a turbine engine to the shaft.
Maybe yes, maybe no. It could have been a airboat turbojet engine. And because of what the hull was doing to the water and the high-speed air coming off of the jet engine, it was stirring up water and making steam behind it. But you're not quite sure, Paul, if the thrust was coming from water being squirted out of this boat or air squirting out from this boat. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, it might be air because, you know, I didn't see any intake on the sides or on the bottom. But maybe it is air. Don't know, but I'm going to look into it. I wish they were going to stay around longer, but they were gone. And like John says, I think it's a turbo system. You know, you can tell, you know, the thing was like, it would race up, you know, about 3 or 4 seconds, and then it would take off. You know, that was directly hooked to the water. I mean, that thing would have been moving right away. So, that's the way the turbos are. Like, you know, you get like a turbo helicopter or something, and those things, they'll spin up and get louder and louder and louder, and then they'll be able to, you know, convert their power to the shaft. Back to you there.
Paul, this event that you witnessed, did that occur on a Saturday afternoon? And do you think those guys come back each Saturday afternoon, or was it a Saturday morning? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, that was a Saturday. Wait a minute. No, that was a Sunday, and then I went back Saturday, the following Saturday, and they were not there. So maybe they're there on Sundays. I should go back on Sunday morning.
So you saw them Sunday morning, and they left the lake before noontime?
Yeah. Definitely Sunday morning. Sunday, yeah. You know, 11 o'clock at that time. 10:30, 11 o'clock. So they were gone probably 11:30.
I think there are a couple of model aircraft and model boat clubs that quite frequently use Lake Ronkonkoma. So they probably are there periodically. They probably are a group similar to Silent Flyers of Long Island. Seafly. Silent Flyers. They call themselves Seafly. The Silent Flyers of Long Island are a major club of aircraft people that fly out in the Holtsville area, Holbrook-Holtsville area, most weekends. So you were there with your grandchildren in the park that overlooks Ronkonkoma. You heard the sound and walked over there with your grandkids to see what's going on. That's what happened, Paul?
Yeah, Dick. And it's on the Islip side. You know, you've got the Brookhaven side, and you've got the Islip side. What's good about this time of year, although I'm a resident, after Labor Day, now anybody can go in there, you know. It's open to the public.
So this was the Islip side, which I think is the southern side of the lake, is that true?
Probably what? Yeah, that's Motor Parkway. Get down there. You come off the LIE. You go on exit 59, follow that around, and eventually you'll see the entranceway on the right-hand side. Maybe it can't be a mile from the LIE.
I think I heard LDY. Go right ahead. Give us your full call and name, sir. My name is Dick.
Yeah, hi, Dick. This is Don, Delta Oscar November, and the call sign is November 2, Lima Delta Yankee.
Okay, November 2, Lima Delta Yankee. I don't know what you said before that. Tell me your name one more time, and I think you want to make a comment. Go right ahead.
Come on. There is a sailboat club that, you know, sailboats over there. I'm pretty sure it's Sunday mornings. It could be Saturday, but I'm almost positive it's Sunday mornings. And they're usually there, but they don't do power boats. So I guess what he's talking about is over on the Islip Beach. I just wanted to throw that in there.
Okay, I think it's Don. And what did you tell us before you gave me the call letters? You gave me another set of phonetics, and I'm not quite sure what you were telling me. Alpha Oscar November. Oh, I guess you were telling me Don. Yes, you're telling me your name. Okay, yeah, Don. I think you signed into the TechNet a couple times before, haven't you?
Yes, I have signed in here a few times, and, you know, I try to listen most times. I may not sign in, but most times I get there and I try to listen.
What's your favorite band, Don? And lived in Santa Reach for a long time?
Well, yeah, it was, used to be 20 meters.
Kinds of ham radio, and quite often people will try one kind, then go to another kind, and eventually come back to one of the earlier kinds for nostalgic reasons or whatever. That's where their friends are. I spend an awful lot of my time on the frequencies 432 and above. Until I got involved in this technical net, I wasn't on 2 meters FM very much. 2 meters sideband I used a fair amount. 432 sideband I used a whole lot. In 10 states from the conference up at Enfield. There's a group that calls themselves the Microwave Update Group. They meet once every year, once every 2 years, of 1,000 megacycles. And I was talking to VE4MA today, where he's done quite a bit of moon bounce on 10,000, 5,000, I think it is, moon bounce. And he owns traveling wave tubes that can put out numbers like 100 and 125 watts at 24,000 megacycles. We're talking about some rather exotic machinery that I don't think you could buy a surplus discarded tube. And a person who's smart enough can take a traveling wave tube that has been discarded because they think it's out of life, focused as it used to be. And the periodic permanent magnet of refrigerator magnet, while observing power output gain and helix current. You carefully tune that. You can take a tube that somebody thought was at end of life, and you can get a lot more performance than when the tube was brand new. And if you're careful, you'll get that service out of that tube for the next 10 years. That's what these guys are doing. Something like 36 dB of gain. It's going to have something like 42 dB of gain at 24 gigs, at 47 gigs. You can see the gain goes up real fast. The parabolic antenna, about a foot down to 1 degree of beam width real fast. And so their biggest problem is, of course, building the transmitter because you can't buy that, building the receiver because you can't buy that, setting up the antenna. Start off with a 1 mile range, and eventually you try a 10 mile range across mountaintops and things like this. And so precisely aiming an antenna to the nearest 1 degree or so is about as bad as what the guys with laser to a small fraction of 1 degree. So let me drop this. Some of these guys will say that no frequency. To them, the frontier is the higher frequency, because everyone thinks that when you go to a higher frequency that you're going to get more atmospheric absorption, you're going to get shorter range, you develop the right kind of range. Who would ever think that at the 10,000 meg ham band, you get a band opening of hundreds of miles every single day if you're on the eastern seaboard, if you're within 200 miles of a major body of water like the Atlantic Ocean? You get a band opening on the 10,000 mega ham band every day, and that band opening gives you 10 times normal range. FM modulated diode front end gun flexor transmitters, except for a couple of rare occasions, that's sort of what you saw. When you started building narrow band, single sideband capability techniques, which have 20 or 30 decibels, you start finding things you didn't know that were there. And these guys are discovering what's the advantage of circular polarization versus linear polarization at 24,000 megacycles when you're doing moon bounce. This guy, VE4MA, has talked to moon bounce people, and I think he's talked to 9 different individuals on the 24,000 megacycle ham band, 9 gigahertz, 9 different individuals off the moon. That's a very rare community, as you can tell. One ham radio operator per 500 in the general population. Let me drive. Canada, United States, Germany, England, Japan, Australia. Roughly one ham per 500 in the general population. These very serious microwave people who are willing to build their own hardware. And they've got their listservs where they talk to each other. only one of them. General population. That's a real subculture if there ever was one. Well, 130 of these guys from 20 states and 5 countries will get together once every year or two on an event called the Microwave Update for 3 days. They give each other lectures, show each other the hardware, and talk to each other until 2 o'clock in the morning and tell each other war stories about what they're doing. Very intense group. I've gone to a couple of their meetings. It's something else. You think you know ham radio. It's very different when you talk to those particular groups. Anybody with any further questions or comments? K2RIW on the TechNet. Takes all kinds. And they've all served their purpose. You could say it was a ham radio operator who essentially invented the thing that you now call a cell phone. When hams were starting to experiment with phone patches on their FM repeaters in the late 60s and early 70s, they really were doing the early version of what is now called a cell phone. And from my point of view, the major man who developed the cell phone is W2CQH, Dr. Reed Fisher, at the Murray Hill Bell Laboratories. He was one of the major developers, in my opinion. An unsung hero. You go and Google who invented the cell phone, and you get a name of a person from Motorola who made the first cell phone contact on a completely developed cell phone system with its base station. So he made the first cell phone contact, and what he did, and who did he call? He called up his rival at Bell Laboratories and said, "Aha, see what I've got." So he's given credit for inventing it. I don't think he invented it. He led a group of people that did some of the final development of the actual hardware that got deployed. And yes, he did a valuable thing. He's the real inventor of the concept. I ought to look back and see if there really were any patents filed on it. Did anybody really get rich quick on the patent itself? It's an interesting question. Anybody know anything more about cell phones? Give me a call letters right now. K2RIW.
WS2N, different topic.
Go ahead, Paul.
I found your article from 1972. I can't find the cover, but I found the 8 pages.
So in other words, the third or fourth try with the ARRL archives, they finally let you see the 8-page article called The 12-Foot Stress Parabolic Dish. Is that true?
Oh, it would have been done the first time about a year ago when I tried, but operator ever creeps in. You know, that website, I click on this, click on that, next thing I know, I'm gone. And I got better at it after a year.
What did you use as a search word in that archive to find that particular article, Paul?
Well, you know, of course, got to be a member. And then what I did is you go to QST, you know, there's a bunch of things to choose from on the top. And then you click on QST, and then a whole bunch of things come up on the QST on the left-hand side. And one of the things that come up is QST Archive. So you click on that. And then you put in 1972, then you put in August, you know, you have little boxes that you go to, and you put all the years up, and you choose 1972, you choose August, and then you click on that, and then they ask you for search words. You know, after you do that, you know, put in a call letter, or put in the topic, or whatever it is that you're looking for within this monthly, you know, August 1972, you're under that group now. So then I put in your call letter, and that's it. This pops up, and you see your name and call letter, and
Yeah, try it a second time.
Parabolic dish or something. I click on that, and then the whole 8 pages come up. You can't copy it, by the way, so it must be the property of the ARRL. I tried to copy it and save it to the computer. You can't do it.
I was able to copy it and save it. So there is a way. So your real search word, once you got to the right month and year, was the call letters. John, what were you saying? John was saying that you had to search 2 times in a row or something like that. Over to you, John.
No, I was kidding, Dick. I said let him try it a second time to see if it works, because that is frustrating, right?
You better believe it. There are some days where I can look for one of my articles where I know the name, I know the call letters, I know the month, I know the year, I know the page number, and it says there's no such reference, no such object. And so I say to myself, you blankety-blank liar. That can be a very frustrating website. You take, for instance, Google. You want to search something in Google. You can have a 5-word or 4-word search criteria where you have misspelled every one of the words, and Google will say, did you really mean this spelling? It is very friendly. Whereas in this particular one, you better keep it simple, because if you make a minor error in any of your search criteria, it'll tell you there's no such record. You got to keep it very simple. So, month, year, and call letters finally got you there. And I know there's a way of storing it. I've done it, Paul. If need be, I'll get you a copy and store it and send it to you. Yes, they do give you a bunch of warnings saying that you got to be careful what you do with it. You're not allowed to go and publish it. But there is a way of storing it. John, have you been able to store any of those articles you find in the archives?
Yes, I have, Dick. I haven't done it lately. Maybe they changed it. I don't know. But I remember last year I was doing it.
Yeah, me too. I last stored one of those articles, a few months ago. Maybe they've made a change. So when you tried storing it, did it just give you an error or saying you're not allowed to store it? Well, what happened there, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
I'm guessing it's me. You know, it's a PDF file. And anytime I get into PDF files, I find it hard to copy anything. It's probably doable. I probably just got to find a way around it. No big deal. What I did is I went to the URL, save that on the favorites, and this way, you know, I'll click on that, then I don't have to go through the whole routine to find that, and then what I'll do is, you know, just put your call letter in at the end, and then the same thing would pop up, so I'll get there that way.
PDF stick, he should be able to print it. If he can print it, he can save it.
I agree. Hit your call down for file, and then choose Save As. I think you can decide what format you save it in and what title under which it's saved. Is that approximately correct, John, if you remember? KC2WGB, K2LIW?
Yes, I believe so, Dick. Either that or right-click on the mouse while you're on the subject, and it will ask you what you want to do. Print, save, forward, you know, that type of stuff.
And nothing happens. I tried right-clicking, John. This is a PDF, and I don't have a, you know, how you go up and hit file and then save as. There's none of that. None of that for an option. I know what I'll do. I'll get on the LimeWire computer net. That's what we'll do. We'll get straightened out that way.
Do you have a Microsoft system, or do you have a, I can't even think of the name of the other one. You know what I mean.
Apple.
Yeah, Apple. Microsoft, or do you have a Linux? What is your operating system, Paul?
This is Vista, and it's Microsoft. I'm in another world with these computers. When I went to Field Day, I got a big kick out of it. Rich says, you know, because I'm going crazy trying to use the blogging program. You know, I never bothered with the blogging program. How could you know all this stuff about NASA and not know how to use this blogging program? So I got my daughter to straighten this out. You know, she's my expert with a computer. Many years working with computers, so no problem, man.
Yeah, my son is the computer maven in my house, and because he does such a beautiful job of maintaining the multiple machines that my wife and I use, that we haven't had to learn really how to use them, so to speak. The good news is he does the work for us. The bad news is that we never learn. So if he's not around and I get in trouble, and I can't get him on the other end of the twisted pair, I usually don't get a correction. There's something about my Linux system that when I try to order anything from Amazon, it's always complaining about cookies. So I have to order Amazon things, and I guess also a number of these other websites where you can buy things from. I have to do it with other computers than my main one in the house. There's something about the firewall system and everything else that we got that just won't allow ordinary ordering. The machines I go to become unhappy. The sites I go to become unhappy. Someday I'll figure out what all is going on there. Okay. Have you guys actually run out of subjects you want to discuss tonight? Has that finally happened after all these years on TechNet number 1371?
No way. No, I have a question. I just not have a question.
Okay. I'm hearing a lot of response. I think John was the first one I heard. Go ahead, John.
I'm just inquiring if you know and if you can say, our good friend Mel, have you gotten any information?
If I didn't have a major repair this afternoon, I was going to call him. I do promise to call him. So that's a very pertinent question. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, to XGN. You can take a look at the email that I sent you, the last one, out of three. The first one is for you to prepare for, and the second one too. So we're not going to discuss that. The third one is the last one. If you can open that one. Now, that one is for the completely explosive ultra compact high voltage nanosecond pulse generating system. There is a drawing on the second page. There are a few pages only on the right hand side, and it's a figure 2, and it's a vector inversion generator. Now, at first, vector inversion generator is one of the devices used also in another application that was discussed in email 1 and 2, but that is not for today. And also, another question that I had, easy one, which one do you want to start with? ERP and EIRP, the difference between them, and any comment, and to exit.
Now, when it comes to ERP, the FCC uses those words to describe the amount of power the transmitter is radiating without consideration of the gain of the antenna. Huh. One of these sites is very difficult to turn it off once you turn it on. I found a email from you which has two sites to go to. That was the email that was issued today at 4:39 in the afternoon.
Let's forget about it now. Look at the titles of one. Forget about it for tonight. this is a very important message that I wanted to send you, very important one. But look at the third one, the last one, that was sent like an hour ago, 2 hours ago. That one is related to the completely explosive, ultra-compact, high-voltage nanosecond pulse generating system. And I just thought that may be entertaining for the people to talk about the difference between ERP and EIRP. So, you know, that will be not such difficult the subject. Whichever one you choose, if you decide to choose that hard one, talking about page number 2, that would be the second page. It's not really number 2, it's the second page from the top. And
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, I see something here called vector inversion generator on this article. Explosive, ultra-compact, high-voltage, nanosecond pulse generating system. Review of science instruments. I guess this is by somebody from Missouri.
Russian guys from Missouri. Right, and Jason Byard, that was the only American. U.S. Army Space and Missile Defense Command, Huntsville, Alabama.
Is this a first generator you're describing?
Yeah, there's a well-known technique for generating a very high pulse energy for a brief period of time for these high-power microwave transmitters, where you create a magnetic field within a container, explode a pyrotechnic which compresses the magnetic field very rapidly so that all of the energy of the magnetic field comes out in an extremely brief period of time. It's a one-time event, but you can get tremendous amounts of energy out of that technique. That's what I think this thing is.
Yeah, John, TK have used in the aquarium. He used that vector inversion generator. Do you understand how it works if you look at the figure number 2?
It looks like the explosive charge is compressing something that previously had a current flowing through a coil, which was a self-contained magnetic field. Are we taking a charged magnetic field and compressing it to get all the energy back out in a short period of time? Is that approximately what's going on in figure number 2?
In figure number 2, we have a shockwave ferroelectric generator. Remember, some time ago, I was talking about ferroresonance. And basically what is happening is the vector inversion generator is a capacitor made exactly the same way as Tesla envisioned that. Now, in other words, in his I was able to track some documents that were were confiscated by government of United States. After the death of Nikola Tesla, he used a similar concept to power his car from the electricity when he made his experiment. Enter a cheer.
In figure number 1, where they talk about PZT, Papa Zulu Tango, is that a piezoelectric material?
Be honest, I have to change, put my glasses on, hold on. Getting old, Dick.
If you're over 50, things like that start happening.
I thought the words were just getting smaller.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of people who say, I can no longer do that work because my eyes are not good enough. I don't accept that. If you buy the right kind of a stereo zoom microscope, and use a bright enough light, the right kind of a light source, as long as your eyes work at all, you can see anything that you've ever seen in your youth. It's just you have to use other instrumentation. So an awful lot of the fine work I do on very small integrated circuits requires microscope work. And so the fact that I have to use a microscope all the time doesn't bother me. Yes, when I was 20 years old, I could focus on something that I put at the end of my nose, and I was getting a magnified view. And my eyes don't have that degree of adaptability anymore. Adaptability, I guess, is the right word. Compensation, adaptability, adjustability, you know what I mean. But with the right kind of a microscope, I can still do the work, as long as you've got a steady hand. I think it was another person who wanted to make a comment, too. While we're studying this thing, was there a third person, K2RIW, listening?
And Wally what?
Okay, go ahead, Paul. Oh, wait a minute now. Sorry about that, Jeff. Don.
Yeah. I was just going to say I'm holding a copy of my amateur license here that just came in the mail. I had to renew. And I guess now I'm good till 12/10/2021. So I got a few more years. My original license, I think, was back in 91.
Yeah, I believe all renewals now are 10 years. I think they used to be 5, and they're now 10 years. So what you're going to have to do, Don, is to make sure that you eat the right amount of vegetables, do the right amount of exercise, do the right amount of safe driving, to make sure you'll be around to really use that license 10 years from now. Over to you, Don. What's that, John?
I have in my possession a USB mic microscope. Very nice. I have 21-inch widescreen monitors, and this little device works great. I got about a year and a half. I say that you can buy them now for around $60 or $50, but that time I bought it 2 years ago, I paid about $150. Excellent little item, and I use that on the same circuit because I have a little macular degeneration and a retinopathy, so it helps me a lot.
Okay, I'm ready, guys.
I think you're saying this is a television camera-like thing that displays on a cathode ray tube. Does it give you a stereo image? I doubt it. Does it give you a color image? It gives you an expanded color image. Is that what you're saying, John? Go ahead.
Actually, it's a CCD device, and it just plugs into the USB port, some simple software, and I put it on the printed circuit board. It comes up in color. Beautiful.
Can you change the degree of magnification or how close you're focusing?
Yes, you can change the focusing. You can't change the magnification. It's about a 10 power, but it does the job. And it's a little more convenient to use than my Bosch and Lomb, the big one, or the Zeiss. They're a little cumbersome.
Are you saying it has a so-called macro lens?
It has a little CCD, very small lens. And it's a macro lens. Beautiful job.
What's the closest at which it'll focus, John?
Oh, what, about an inch?
That's a macro lens. So it focuses anywhere from an inch out to infinity?
Oh, negative. I would say within 6 inches. An inch to 6 inches.
Not what we said earlier, but I missed it. What is the name of the device and the brand name?
Believe it or not, the label's off. It's one of those things made in China, and they're available on eBay. Just type it in and eBay, and it'll come right up. And it has like a cord art that's about 3 feet long. The whole device is only 5 inches long, maybe 130 millimeters, something like that. And it's approximately 25 millimeters in diameter.
You said type it in. You got to give me a little bit more hint than that, John. Go ahead.
Microscope or USB microscope, and it'll come right up.
Okay, USB microscope, And is there a brand name?